Okay, so thank you very much. I'd like to thank the organizers. okay, but actually, so I wasn't supposed to talk. I'm taking the place of Juan de Pablo, who had to beg out of this because of a medical emergency at home. So I apologize for not being Juan. Okay, so what I'd like to do, the talk really has two parts that I've prepared. One is I just want to say a few general things about memory, because somehow the more I talk to people here, the less we seem to actually know what it is and what it is that we're after in this whole program, in this conference. And just like to at least give my take on this a little bit. And then I want to go on and talk about one particular aspect of what Juan would have said something about, and then go on with that and say a little bit about what memory is. So, what I'm hoping from, learning from this is that somehow, we study materials in all sorts of ways, and one question that seems to be a little bit newer to ask is, well, to what extent are these materials encoding some kind of a memory? And if they do encode this kind of memory, is that a kind of a useful thing for practical purposes? Or more to the point is, well, by asking those questions, have we learned something about the material or the process of making that memory, how we've manipulated the material? And so, you can ask, well, what is a memory? And so, my very simple-minded version of this is, well, it's stored information about past history of the material. And so this is a very, very general thing. And one question that, we've debated is, well, is this too general to be have any teeth in it? Or is it somehow the start of asking a certain kind of question that can lead us someplace in some cases? And so the idea is, well, can the information left behind, either by design of the material, as we heard in some of the talks, such as Zorana's talk, is you're designing the material, and so it then has a memory, or manipulation of the materials, such as what we heard in the sheared suspensions. These are ways of doing something to the material, and there's information left behind in doing that, and does this provide any kind of insight into the process or the material? And the main question is, after we've done all of this, is a study of this residual information content useful at all? And so that if it isn't useful, then we shouldn't do this. If it does prove to be useful, a productive way of thinking about materials, a slightly different way than we have in the past, then maybe this is worth doing. So there was a famous choreographer, Twyla Tharp. She wrote a book, and I found this quote there, which is, I thought, very apropos. She says, and she's a dancer, so this is very important to her. And she says, there are as many forms of memory as there are ways of perceiving, and every one of them is worth mining for inspiration. And that, I think, is kind of what I kind of like about this is, are there different ways of perceiving the material? And can we get inspiration by doing that kind of examination? So in that spirit, I just wrote down a whole bunch of examples of memory. And there are a lot of them. And I have a lot of questions about these, but I've tried to divide them up into a few categories. So at the top, I wrote things that we've certainly knew about for a long time ago. There's, you have a stone and chisel, or you write on a sheet of paper, and this is certainly a memory. You have a photograph, that's a memory, or a phonograph record, or CD, it's an oral memory. We certainly know about computers and magnetic domains flipping, and this is certainly a form of memory. And the associative memory that we've heard about several times in this conference of the neural nets, the Hopfield model. And so all of these are one kind of memory that we somehow have been hearing about, and the information is somehow stored in some some aspect of the material that we've been able to write on it, and maybe they're stored in some kind of potential well, such as they are in the Hauffield model. Then there's another whole class of materials that are put here in blue, such as the Kaiser effect, the Kovacs effect. These are remembering something about the largest strain you've put on a material, or remembers the waiting time, as we'll hear, I guess, a little bit about tomorrow. And then there are the return point memories, which we heard about in Jim's talk this morning, and these nested hysteresis curves. And one question is, how are all of these related? And I think the idea of thinking of these as all as a kind of memory, which is not how we typically have been thinking about them, gives some insight as to how these things may be related to one another. That is, that there is something different about return point memory, or there's something similar about the return point memory. Remember, it's the last thing you've gone to, but it has nested hysteresis curves, whereas the others don't. And so this is somehow giving us some insight as to something different about materials and the way we're dealing with it. And then there are a bunch of other things that we've heard about. I won't go through all of these. I mean, I just have to mention it here that echoes, I think echoes are, the spin echoes are just a beautiful form of memory, and I don't know how to place them in any other of these categories. And so I don't know exactly what to say about that, except that it's a memory, it's a surprising memory, but exactly then what do you want to say about it? And so there are the shape memory alloys, and as I said at the very beginning, designing in the function, and that's kind of a memory that you've implied from the outset. Okay, so these are some of the vast list of memories that you can think about, and there are a bunch of questions that we could ask about them, and these are some of the questions that I'd like to just say what I find fascinating about this. And so, one of the things at the very beginning is, well, what constitutes a memory? I mean, it's this thing that, I know one when I see one, but I don't know how to really define it. And so I tried to say something very early on the first slide, but, that's so general that I'm not quite sure it really is helpful about when we talk about one memory or another kind of memory. What exactly is it that forms a memory, that makes it a memory, and is it a useful concept? And then more interesting to me is, are there different categories of memory? How would we want to think of these memories as being one category or another category? I mean, they clearly, every memory is a memory in and of itself, but they certainly seem to have different flavors from one to another, and can we enumerate them? And, so how many memories can be stored in these different cases? What is the memory capacity? What is the plasticity? What allows the system to continue to remember as time goes on? And then there are the principles used to store memories, and so what does it need? And so there are a few ingredients that we've heard about during the conference so far. Well, it certainly needs many degrees of freedom. If there are no degrees of freedom, there's nothing to be remembered. It has to be out of equilibrium. If it's in equilibrium, I mean, yes, Newton is time reversible, but you can't follow anything, so you need to have it at a more global level to be able to see something, and so you have to be out of equilibrium to be able to measure something about it. It can't be chaotic, and we heard yesterday in Irmgard's talk about that there shouldn't be any instability. The instability will just erase the memory, and so it's somehow quieting down the instabilities allows memories to persist. And then there was this two other example things that I guess I've noticed so far in various talks that we've had is that there seem to be these two classes of memories. One is, I'll start with the one here, which is maybe how I first thought of memories. Well, it's something is stored in the ground state of a material. So the Hauffield model is, you have a ground state or a potential well, so you have a complicated energy landscape and there's a potential well, and that's where you put the memory, and so you can retrieve it from there. And so that's somehow the memory is stored in the static positions of the spins or particles. But there's this other kind of memory which is somehow very important for materials, which is somehow how the memory is stored in the path, how you go from one point to another point in this. And so these are the ideas of marginal states that I first heard of in Sue's work on the charge density waves, trying to understand the pulse duration memory effects, where you keep pushing and pushing and pushing, and you get to that last state, and then you can remember how far you pushed because You've done that already, and you somehow cleared out that path between where you started and that last state. And so these seem to be two kinds of memories, classifications of memories, which somehow rely on somewhat different principles. And then what I get very confused is where when you have both acting at the same time, and I don't really know what to say about that. So this is what I wanted to say at the beginning, you know, just to set the stage of at least how I'm thinking about memories in general in this context. And now I want to start thinking a little bit more about the work we've done in one area of this, which is memories in complex energy landscapes. And so we heard a lot here so far, and so from Itai's talk at the very beginning was, you know, how you can have periodic shearing in a system, and this trains the system into a periodic orbit. And when it's doing this, it traverses many energy barriers and visits many energy minima on the way from one side to the other. And yet, the memories are very easy to encode, that it only takes a few oscillations and suddenly this thing has found that state. And that's a memory that it's remembered what its process was. If you had done it at a different shearing amplitude, it would have remembered that shearing amplitude. And so it can't be doing too much. It can only break a few bonds of just a few neighbors, and yet it's able to do that. And so the point I want to say, so here are these energies in these memories in these complex energy landscapes. That's one of them. But there's another one that's coming from exactly the same thing, which feels a little bit as if it has some of the same flavor at some level, and that so I'm going to be talking now about this tuning by pruning mechanism that we've been working on that also starts with this complex energy landscape, and from that we're able to encode surprisingly a large amount of information. And so that's what I want to talk about. That's what Juan, I think, would have been telling us about. And so just to start this off, just to make sure that starting at the beginning, I just want to remind people what that there are various kinds of moduli of a solid. So if I take a material, there's one thing which is the bulk modulus, and so what is the bulk modulus? Well, I squeeze a material from all sides, and it costs a certain amount of energy to do that, and so that the amount of energy it takes to squeeze is a measure of the bulk modulus. And so the bulk modulus is one of the common moduli we measure. There's another moduli, which is the shear modulus, which is where you don't change the volume, but you just take the material, and the simple this case is you just take it and you shear it in one direction, and so that's what I'm showing here. And now it takes energy to shear that material, and so it takes some energy, and so the shear modulus is basically the energy it takes to do that kind of motion. And in each case, what you're doing is you're taking these atoms in the material and squeezing them into each other, and so you have a potential energy, and they both ram into each other. And so typically in a crystal, the shear modulus and the bulk modulus are comparable to one another. And so certainly they come in at different angles, and so maybe there's a square root of 3 or some cosine effect, but they're of the same order of magnitude. They're not vastly different. I choose these two moduli because their ratio, G over B, is related to what's called the Poisson's ratio. So the Poisson's ratio is the, typically, if I take a material and I pull it, it's going to get thinner in this direction. Okay, that's normal Poisson ratio. That's a positive Poisson ratio. And if it's completely incompressible, that is, the volume hasn't changed at all, that would have a Poisson's ratio of in three dimensions of plus 0.5. In two dimensions, would be plus 1. But it's just saying that that's the for an isotropic material, that's the largest Poisson's ratio we can get. On the other hand, there are a few materials which behave in a weird fashion. And those are negative Poisson's ratio, where if I pull it in this direction, it actually expands in these other directions as well. Okay, and so that's, you know, that's not what we typically expect from a solid, and so that's why it's kind of weird. Most solids don't do that. And the solid that's most like that, that I know of, that's generally available, is the corks in your wine bottle, which have a Poisson's ratio close to zero, because you don't want to, when you push it in, for it to expand and that'll break the bottle, or if you then try and pull it out, it'll just zip right out. I mean, that would be the normal material, and that would be a bad cork, right? And so cork is used because it has basically a zero Poisson's ratio. So it doesn't really go into this weird regime, but it's around zero. But what I've drawn here is just ordinary elasticity. This is a three-dimensional case of that the Poisson's ratio is just a monotonic function of that ratio G over B. So if I know the shear and the bulk moduli, I know what the Poisson's ratio is. And so from an engineering point of view, if you can make readily negative Poisson's ratios materials, that opens a new door into various kinds of manufacturing, perhaps. I mean, that's what the hope is, because you're making these new kind of weird materials. And so I told you that crystals all have G comparable to B. The shear and bulk modulus are comparable to each other. And so what I want to ask here is, does disorder matter? So if I took a really disordered material, would that make a difference to whether, you know, to what kind of Poisson's ratio I would have and what kind of material I would get? So what I'm going to be talking about now are networks. And so I just want to tell you very, very briefly, you know, where these networks come from. And it's these networks that I can tell you about. My guess is a lot of the stuff I'm going to tell you about is more general. It didn't have to come from these particular networks. But the only thing I can say for sure is that this is, for these networks, this is the behavior. So we start with a Jahn packing. And so we take a packing and we put spheres in a box. And we squeeze and squeeze and squeeze until either they've just touched in this case and they begin to put forces on one another, or I can, if they're soft spheres, I can squeeze even farther, and so now we have some overlapping. And what we do is we take the center of a sphere, we put a dot there, and we look at where all its neighbors are, and we just replace the spheres by an unstretched spring between the centers of connected spheres. Okay, so this is then the spring network. So each one of these are unstretched springs. They came from putting nodes at the centers of the spheres, and where the spheres were touching each other, that's where we put a spring. So that's what our system is. So we started with this jam system, and we can do this in two dimensions or three dimensions. Either way, this is what we're starting with. Okay, so let me ask, so what would I have if I had a crystal? And so, you know, what can I expect? And, you know, I want to ask, are these jam solids, these disordered networks, somehow intrinsically different from what I would get in a crystal behavior? And so in a crystal, so think of, you know, the simplest possible crystal, a square lattice with one atom per unit cell. I mean, so this is it. And I want to, so what is a crystal? Well, it's a unit cell repeated over and over and over and over again, interminably in all directions in space, right? And so it's just this one thing over and over, symmetrically and interminably. Okay, and so if I look at that and I ask, okay, so let me ask about that bulk modulus I told you about. And so I look at this thing, and I squeeze it, and I look at each of the bonds, and all bonds are squeezed by exactly the same amount. That's because all the crystals, all the unit cells, do exactly the same thing. Okay, so what I'm after here is, well, suppose I go into this crystal, and I take one bond, and I pull it out of the lattice. The bulk modulus will change by some small amount. And I ask, OK, how much did it change? And so I record that. And now I put that bond back, and I go in, and I reach another random bond, and I take it out. I will get exactly the same change in the bulk modulus. That is, it doesn't matter which bond I take out, because all bonds are created equal in this case. And so, pardon? I have boundary conditions on this tree.
Shut up.
This is what happens for the simplest case of just removing a bond. And so all bonds contribute the same to the moduli. And now the other thing that I want to emphasize here is that if I remove any bond in this material, both the shear modulus and the bulk modulus will decrease in tandem. They will both decrease by some fraction, 1 over n of the things in the system, because each one of them is contributing the same. And so each bond does the same kind of thing to both of the moduli in our system. OK, so basically, crystals are very dull. Right? They're simple. They're nice, but they don't give us a whole lot of flexibility. And the question is, if you had a random network, if you had one of these jam networks, would you get would you be able to do more with it than I've just talked about here? So in putting this the way I was just explaining to you, so here's what I'm doing. So if removing one bond, I get a change of the modulus of size delta B, then independent of which bond I've taken out, the probability of finding a delta B is just going to be the same independent of which bond I've taken out. So I'm just going to get a delta function in this simple case of one atom per unit cell. And so this is will just be a delta function. Now, what I'm asking is, well, what will disorder do to this? And so what my naive expectation what I would guess is, OK, you put disorder in, and it's just going to take that delta function, and it's going to smear it out a bit. And so maybe it'll be a Gaussian around this thing. And so this is what disorder would do. And what I want to show you now is what actually happens when we took that lattice, network that I showed you before from the jam system. And so this is the behavior that you get instead. And so what you see is, first of all, this is a log scale. Okay, and this is a log scale. So it wasn't just on a linear scale anymore. What we're seeing is that over many orders of magnitude, you see that this probability distribution of getting a value of delta B or delta G is very, very broad and continuous. And it's basically universal. That is, I get the same distribution whether I'm looking at the changes in delta B, the change in the bulk modulus, or in the change in the shear modulus. Both of them are doing the same thing. And there's a little caveat here, which I'm not going to go into. But there is a caveat about that aspect of it. But basically, they are universal functions, universal functions which we can show has this particular form. And they cover an enormous range, and they're continuous. OK, so then the second question that I asked was, well, suppose I take out a bond that had a very, very large contribution to the bulk modulus. I want to ask, well, what does it do to the shear modulus? And my guess would have been, just like for the crystal, if it has a big effect on the bulk modulus, it probably would have a big effect on the shear modulus. That is, if bond is important, this is important, right? That's how I would have guessed it. Well, it turns out that that's not the case. That is, if you take out a bond that is, let's say, very large to the bulk, important for the bulk modulus, it's totally uncorrelated with what it does to the shear modulus. So it covers, it could have been anywhere in that distribution, and there's no correlation with what it did for the bulk modulus. So these two things are really independent of one another. And so, and likewise for taking it at any G, any shear modulus bond, it's independent of what it would, what you've gotten in the bulk modulus is independent of that. And so, and this is kind of what this is showing, because I didn't tell you before that all these different colors are, one is partly bulk modulus, partly shear modulus, but they're also for different distributions, for the bulk modulus that's close to the maximum, in the middle, and a little bit below the middle, all the way down to the very lowest. All of these things are these different distributions, and they all look the same. That's what it means to be uncorrelated, okay? So you have this, and so what can you do with this? And so I was interested in this idea of looking at the ratio of G over B, because that's what tells me about the Poisson's ratio in this kind of material. And so there was this earlier work by Zurana and her colleagues, which took a jam system and took out bonds at random. And if you take out bonds at random, and you don't think anything is going to really change about what the ratio of G over B is, because these things are taken at random, so there's no, if you took out a bond that was important for B at one point, next time you might take out a bond important for G, and so these things will average out at the end, and so you get, they had a very flat distribution for what you get in as you take bonds out. And I should just point out, what is this x-axis here? This x-axis here is the excess number of contacts that the system has above the isostatic limit. That is, if delta z were zero, that is all the way down there, in two dimensions it would have had exactly four contacts per node on average, right? So it would have just been on the verge of stability. And so this is basically, all I'm caring about here is just removing bonds, and so going in that direction means I am removing bonds from the system. Okay, so this is what we get for this ratio of G over B in this case. But if you realize what I just told you in the last slide is I can manipulate G or B independently of each other. So that means I could have, instead of taking bonds out at random, I could have picked out the bond that had the largest bulk modulus. So this ratio would have dropped by that amount. But G doesn't go down as much as B, because B was chosen to be the most. G goes down by some average amount. And so what we would get is a curve that looks like this. And so as I take bonds out, the first bond, I increase G over B by a little bit. Then I do the same thing again. I increase G over B by a little bit more, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and I get this curve. Now, what I should point out is this axis is logarithmic. This axis is logarithmic. So this is 10 to the 12. So that's 12 orders of magnitude over where basically I started. Okay, so this has changed it by a lot. But that was by taking out the maximum B. And so, and this is getting me to that auxetic limit. That is, auxetic limit is the negative Poisson ratio limit, where this has the most weird behavior. That is, if I pull in this direction, everything else expands as well. But I could have done something else. I could have taken out the bond that had the minimum change in the bulk modulus, delta B. And then that would have left B basically fixed, but G would have gone down by its average amount each time. And so this ratio would have dropped. And again, we get this curve dropping down. And this goes down to roughly 10 minus 4. So this is 16 orders of magnitude difference between these two systems by pruning this behavior. Okay? And so in this case, we went to the limit of negative 1 Poisson ratio. Here, we're going to the ratio, the Poisson ratio of plus, and this is a 3D system, so this is plus a half. So we can tune this thing anywhere between these two limits. And then we can have done, here I just pulled out what I did with maximum minimum delta B. I could have done this with maximum minimum delta G. And it fills in all four things. Work goes in the same way. And so this is what we're able to do. We're able to tune now by pulling out bonds we have to know something about the system, but we pull out the bonds, we're able to bring the system where we want it. And so what we want to do is we want to make these things in the lab. Okay, and so that's what we're after. So we can do this in two dimensions. So we take a sheet of material, we take it to a laser cutter, and we cut out everything that isn't the network. And so that's what we have here. So this is a real picture. In 3D, it's a little bit more cumbersome because you have to build this thing, but you can do it by 3D printing, and you can print any geometry or topology of this thing that you want. So this is what we wanted to do. And then we've realized that there's a problem, and so this is where Juan de Pablo and his group came in to this, is that this doesn't work so well because we just had unstretched springs, but they had no angle between these things. That is, this was unconstrained, but if you had a real material like what I just showed you here, if I bend one of these bonds, there's a restoring force, and so that bond bending angle is important and is in there. And so this is what he was able to put into the simulations. And so this is the adding the bond bending potential. This is now a experimental system that Nitti was able to create with a laser cutter. And so now this movie will show you, this is a real experiment. So this is a plastic plate moving into this, and you'll see the thing collapse. And so it's moving up, and it's moving in from the sides. So this is a negative Poisson ratio material. It's probably not exactly minus one, but it's significantly negative. Yes, so that comes into the pruning algorithm as well. I mean, it's not, I can't prove the same things I was able to prove without the bond bending, because now these constraints are coupled to one another in a way that I don't quite know how to say something, but it shows that we can go in that direction to real materials and include that. That's right. Okay, so so this is what we had with the for the global moduli. And now the question is, well, is that the only thing? And if that's the case, well, that was nice, but it isn't as general as we would have liked it to be. And so what we want to do is, can we do this for local, not just local, global response? And so the idea here is something we heard about from C's talk yesterday, is this idea that proteins are networks of some kind that have action at a distance in a way. That is, if you put in so if this is your protein and you put in a bond at this point, it somehow manages to make this site way over here have the right shape so that it can bond to the substrate. And so this is what we wanted to do. Could we do this in these network models? And so take this lesson from biology. This is what biology can do. Could we do this with these jam systems, these disordered systems? And so this was done, we heard C's talk, and so is Jan here? Lil Jan? There he is. So he was involved in some similar work in Mathieu Villard's group, and then we heard from Zvi about his work here. So this is something that a number of groups here are interested in. And so I'm just going to tell you the kind of stuff that we were able to do. And so what we wanted to do was the following. So we take a network of this kind, and I ask you to come and choose two points at random on this. And so you come in and you say, okay, these two points, and that's your source. And then I ask you, okay, now tell me, take it, go back, and now come back again. Tell me which points do you want to be the target? And so you told me these two. Now, I can't do this for you here because, yeah, but this is what we did. We asked the computer to choose two points at random, another two points at random. And then I ask, okay, do I want these two points here at the target to move apart when I pull this at the bottom, or do I want them to move together? And the question is, could we do this? I mean, and at the beginning, we didn't know whether we could do this or not. And so let's see if I can. OK, so here is a network that we made. So this then goes to, we design it. And then with the random thing, we did that. We asked, where's the source? Where's the target? And so we made these networks. And so here is one, but actually it's two. So if I take them apart, you see that there are two here. They're almost identical. And now they were so identical, I have to look closely to remember which bonds were taken apart. They're a little bit different. But now if I take these two points here, which are the source points, and I pull them apart, I'm able to make those two points. So this was the target, and we see that the target then pulls apart when I pull the source apart. If I do the same thing now with the other system, I pull on these two things, and now I pull them apart, and they move together. So this is something that we can do with, for systems certainly this size, it's essentially with 100% success rate that we're able to do that. And it doesn't have to be a one-to-one correspondence. We can have one here, and this can be moving by 10. I mean, we can change the amount that we ask the target to change depending on, okay.
Roughly.
Oh, okay. 5 minutes left? Okay. Oh, I started early. Okay, that's why, okay. 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 And so then the question is, if you start with one source, how many different sites can I control? And so here's an example of what we would like to do. So we have the source, and then we have this site over here, which we want to expand by twice as much as we change the source. This one should go as one times what we change the source. This one we change by minus one times what we do the source, as it goes in instead of goes out. So these are the different things, all starting with that one source. And then we ask, how many of these targets can I train? And it depends on the number of nodes I have in the system. And so this is the behavior that we get, which is there's a probability of success. This is the number of targets that I ask it to train. And these are different size systems. And so what it shows is that for a small size system, I can remember a few memories. But then after something here like about four, I only get a 50% probability of being able to train the fifth one. Right? But here, when I had a 4,000 particle system, I can train several hundred independent targets at the same time. And so it really looks like a phase transition from where I can train it to where I can no longer train the system. And so, and the point about this is, how does this point move out? And it moves out sublinearly. So in the infinite size limit, the percentage that I train is zero, but I'm training lots and lots and lots of these things in that limit. That's the part, 0.7. OK, so now I want to get to.
How do you follow these groups? I mean, if you go over the edges,
And so we don't do every, I mean, that's what we're doing is we choose something and then we ask, we give it 30 sites at random to, can you do this? Can you do it? Can you do it? Can you do it? And in the, and what we can do is about, you know, if it's 30 sites for this case, I can do it almost all the time. If and so it's we're sampling. We're not doing anything exhaustively.
I mean, I was thinking of like how do you choose the bones? I mean, do you sample like different removals of the bones?
Or? I'm using the same. I should have said sorry. So what we're doing is it's this. And thank you because this is an important thing for the next segment. What we want to do is do this kind of same kind of algorithm I did with the auxetic, the negative Poisson's ratio material. That is, the idea is I have this thing, I put stresses here and I put stresses there. Which bond, if I remove it, makes the best behavior?
So, this also depends on sort of what you mean connectivity?
Not that much. I mean, that is, it probably does some, but I don't have that information yet. So, this is what we're looking at this point. That's exactly the next point. That's we're going to get to greediness in a second.
So, just for example, the targets are located anywhere throughout the network or only on the border?
So, we've been looking really at the border, but this it doesn't matter that this is, I mean, this we could have had a periodically continued network. And so, it is nothing about the edge. In our case, that matters very much. So we're sampling anywhere in this system. It's not we're not just going around the edge. We're just going throughout the system and choosing bonds at random in there.
The number of control points.
Yeah. So when there were 4,000 bonds of nodes, there are then four times that on average bonds, and you know we can train a few hundred.
Those are 100 pairs on the border.
No. They don't have to be on the border. They don't have to be on the board. Okay. So now this is where I want to get to, and so it matters about this greediness of this algorithm. I mean, it is a greedy algorithm. Okay, and so what we want to ask is, okay, so if I now have a sample, so think of a sand pile, you know, behind a dam, you know, this enormous sand pile under lots and lots of weight. This thing is under incredible pressure. And so you pour the sand in, and you have every right to expect that it's going to be more or less solid for forever. But what actually happens is, well, you push down on this thing, and there are some grains in there which are pushing very hard against one another. Others which are only touching by a little bit, not very much pressure there. What you think is going to happen is that those that are under a lot of pressure are going to plastically deform in time, and those that are not under pressure are going to basically remain the same. And so this is a way for the system itself to train towards some limit. In the case of what I've just told you, we're asking put the system under compression on all sides. This is what the energy of the system is. Li is the length of the bond. Li0 is its unstretched length. And then we ask, well, suppose you let the unstretched length change with time according to how much stress it's under, or in this case, how much strain it's under. And if you let that happen slowly, then you can ask, well, what happens to the bulk modulus and the shear modulus? And just like what I showed you before, the bulk modulus starts to drop, and the shear modulus stays basically the same. These are in two dimensions or in three dimensions. And there are several shear moduli. That's what the different colors for this horizontal line is. And so what this says is that over time, this system is evolving someplace. And it's able to evolve because somehow what I used was this greedy algorithm. But that's what nature seems to be using. It's just saying, what can I go downhill? How can I go downhill? How can I go downhill as fast as possible? And that's what it's basically using. And so it's what I would like to call directed aging in this case. It's directed. It's not just the whole system is getting weaker, which it is, but it's getting weaker with some goal in mind. It's going someplace. It's not just, it's changing its properties. So this is kind of a directed aging, and it doesn't happen just for sand piles, but it would happen to any system under stress as long as the system can couple. And so these are simulations that show that kind of behavior. So now I just want to wrap up, and you know, so material memory, and then what I've tried to say is that we've encoded a pathway for material behavior in the same way that we've heard about other encodings of pathways throughout this conference. There are global ones such as the selecting the Poisson's ratio, the local ones which were based on this idea of trying to mimic biology. And so these are different things that we can train into the system. And now, of course, I have to say that no talk is complete unless you have your bullshit line. And so this is a bullshit line. And so everything before this, you're supposed to believe. Everything afterwards, it's up to you, okay? And so this is where I actually use the idea of this greedy algorithm correctly. So this is speculation and, but how memory can come into this process. And so what I was saying before was the global algorithms the greedy algorithms basically find, know what its slope is and it tries to go downhill. Now, if nature is able to couple to that downhill motion, then it can do the same thing that we were doing in the pruning. And so if the material detects the landscape, it directs the aging in some particular way. Now, I gave you the example of the sand pile, but biology is doing this all the time. I mean, so the bones in your leg, which have the trabecular bone, if you put pressure on it, and your body senses it, and it strengthens those little bits of the bone. And it doesn't strengthen the other ones. So it isn't that the whole bone gets stronger. It gets stronger in for that one kind of behavior, but may leave it very weak for the orthogonal kind of stress on the system. Nature also does this by cutting off, in various networks, they have molecules which choose the ones that are most under stress, and also molecules that choose the ones that are least under stress. So it can do all of these different things, and maybe this is actually changing the nature of the material, not just the material itself. So this is the idea. This is, pure speculation, but it creates a memory because it's remembering its past behavior. As it remembers what stresses it was under all of this time and somehow is evolving according to that, and it evolves to a new place that you didn't know that it was going to. And so this is basically all I want to say, but then of course I want to say to all the people who did all the work here, and so I should say for sure that Andrea Liu was involved in every aspect of this and provide most of the ideas and everything. So she's the main instigator of all of this. Carl Goodrich, who you heard about a little bit earlier, was involved in this tuning by pruning behavior at the beginning. Daniel Hexner, who was Dove's student, did a lot of stuff. He did the stuff on the aging, and he also improved those algorithms to make them actually work in all these different areas. And Jason Rocks was the student who's taken over all of that and done the allosteric work. And then Juan de Pablo and Daniel Reed worked on putting the angles in. And then Nitti and Irmgard is back here someplace, they did the work on actually making these things, fabricating these things so that these kinds of networks that I've shown you here. And then the work on this phase transition behavior was done by Eleni Cadafori and Henrik Roland Ronellen Fitch at the University of Pennsylvania. So thank you very much.
So what you're saying towards the end about this evolution of the sort of the breaking of the weakest links, it's sort of reminiscent of what came up in some earlier discussions about what happens in these shared solids where the local yield stresses, which are the smallest, get sort of eliminated the first. But the resulting behavior seems to be, there seems to be an analogy, but I can't.
So the thing is that what I'm trying to argue in those the last part of this, below the bullshit line, is that this is a very general kind of behavior.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't think of aging particularly as going someplace, but this is saying this should be a general way of thinking about what aging does. It doesn't just deteriorate the material. It deteriorates it with a goal in mind. It doesn't have a mind, but with a goal in view. And so, yes, I think it should do that, but it will do surprising things. When we put it under shear, actually, it did something quite different according to these algorithms. Yeah. And who knows whether this algorithm was the right algorithm. I mean, it's a made-up algorithm, and to try and see if that behavior works. And so that's what I'm done.
I have a question about the greedy algorithm. After that, you remove the bond of the best score, and you're going to remove the next one. Do you recompute the scores?
Yes.
Okay.
That is, if you just did it at the beginning, it would be an easy calculation. You just pull out all the ones because but you have to let this thing change. And then what all the hard work was, from my point of view as an experimentalist, I just go in and clip them, right? I mean, that's the thing, and I find out which one. But there are what these people have figured out is how to do this computationally elegantly, so you don't have to recompute everything each time. So it's so you can do it rather quickly. But from the idea of just the principle of it, it's what I'm saying. You just find out which one is the least, and you cut it.
Thanks.
Other questions?
Do you think this is a result of the self-consistency? Because, it can't violate causality, right? So how would it know that which way it is going to go?
In the case of what I just told you about, that's why I chose a sand pile, underweight, because that's really a compression. And compression is what I just told you about. I said, if something's under compression and I clip the strongest bonds most important bonds for the bulk modulus, it's going to go towards auxetic behavior. Right? That's what I showed you. So that's what this, it's not that it wants to go to auxetic behavior. It's, okay, when I do this, the features of this system change, and this is the way that aging is going to take place. If it was under a shear over many, many years, and it evolved there, then you would get a different behavior evolving, and I don't know which that one will be. But the point is that it'll be something, and it'll be something that having to do with how that greedy algorithm figures out which way to go downhill. And so the idea is, can nature sense the greediness of the algorithm? Right, that's the.
That scaling plot you showed above G over B, over a very large range, 10 raised to 12 to 10 raised to the earlier one for which you had a functional form? That. Is that a measured thing?
There are two things. I mean, the data points are measured from simulations. I mean, this is all simulation stuff. There's this, whatever that color is, what's that color? Cyan. That's the one, cyan. That line goes through this. That's this functional form. And that was the functional form that Daniel Hexner derived for what he thinks, with certain conditions on randomness, was why this. That's the underlying explanation
the numerator is delta G, and then denominator is delta G I over bracket.
Average. So what we're just doing is we're normalizing delta G I by its average value.
I see.
You're asking what this is?
Yeah.
So this is delta G. So this is what would have been a delta function in the crystal,
mm-hmm.
right? And this is its average value, so it, the delta function would have been placed at 1 in the crystal. It was just by, and so this is just the average.
But just to clarify, it's delta because you take the thing, you pull out a bond, and then you get a delta G.
Mm-hmm.
And then you do that for every bond.
Yeah, but I put the bond back, and then I do for the next bond.
Right. You put it back and do whatever you want.
I see.
And then the average is the average.
That's right. Yeah, and so it, that's just a normalization so that all of these things make sense to put them on one curve.
So if you start with a little Pac-Man grabber, if you started from that network and then looked at what the soft modes were, are those then the same easiest things then access for the targets? Is there, can you predict what the easy and hard targets will be?
Yeah, so so I didn't talk about this, but that's a good thing. This is the question I was trying to ask yesterday, was that what we do here is, in this system, for example, I'm putting in energy. It's going to flop right back to where I started. So I'm willing to put in the energy. So by putting in that energy, this is not a zero-frequency mode. It's not a mechanism in the system, but I had to put in some energy. But you can ask, okay, so what are the normal modes of this system? And what is this motion compared to that? Yeah. So you can ask, okay, so put this down on the, look at the projection of the motion of this onto the normal modes. And what it does is that at the beginning, you don't see anything, of course. And then as you keep doing this over and over again, some mode comes out of, or a bunch of modes come out of the band, and they get lower in frequency, and those are the ones that have a high projection onto this behavior, but they're not zero. As you ask it to do more and more, so I prune farther, there are fewer of them, and they're more single mode like things, and the mode goes lower. So if I really go to town all the way, it eventually will get to a zero frequency mode, of course that's what I've done, but it doesn't have to be zero frequency. So that means it's not symmetric on both sides. That was right. That is, if I do it on the target side, I don't necessarily have to get the source to do what. I mean, it's because it's, there are all sorts of other modes that could have interacted with that. That was so, but it is related to normal modes, and they are the lower frequencies coming down.
So, when you talked about the fact that as the system
ages,
when you talk about the fact that the system, as the system ages, it's actually, its properties are evolving, and so one has to think about that, right? So in one can imagine in the case of a real material that there is a time scale associated to that. And so this is going to change the way the aging acts actually on the material. So.
Right.
What is your...
Okay, so I completely agree. An axis here was time. That was some crazy computer time. It wasn't, it was just an evolution time and made up by the computer, by the rules, right? The way it's going to happen in nature, if it happens at all, is going to depend on how deformable the material is, how will it plastically flow, how will that depend on temperature and what temperature cyclings you have in time. Did someone come over and disturb things with a truck going over this thing? I mean, so all those things would come in, and I completely agree, and I don't have anything to say about that. I mean, about real materials. And so what I'd like to find out is, do real materials have this kind of directed aging?
So you looked at delta B and G being uncorrelated for this system you were looking at. How general do you expect that to be? You were simulating some system of, you know.
Yeah. So this is, I don't know about generality. What I can tell you is for the case of disordered solids built on jamming, right? That's what I can tell you. And what you saw was that this was basically the behavior that, that you got. Now, you know, if no one's listening, I mean, I don't think it matters that much that it was started from jamming, but I can't say anything about those, and I don't know how to look at all of them to say what generality is. So we looked at this one class of them just to see what that behavior is. So that's what it is.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting you to say it.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is my knee-jerk reactions, I don't think it matters too much. I'm sure we can think of things where it matters a lot, but I can't say for sure.
Can I ask a related question before you? So how broad do you think
the you need the microphone.
Well, you can get it. How broad do you think the distribution needs to be for this to be a robust? A Gaussian would not do.
A Gaussian would not do. That is, look, what I want is when I take, so for example, if I think of the taking away the smallest thing, well, I really want those to be near zero. Mm-hmm. If they're not near zero, then everything is going down roughly in tandem. That is, they're smaller, but not by a whole lot. But if I really can tune things, pull things away that are near zero, then I really do get that, the
so
range
you need
of stuff.
The distribution.
So I need the distribution to be wide, and particularly I think I need it going as towards zero. That is, I think, and that's, I think that's what I
When the system reaches maximal capacity, the network, does it have special structural or topological properties?
That's a great question. I certainly don't know the answer. Worse is I don't think I know how to even quiz the system, but maybe you could give me ideas. I would love to know what, you know, why it's ending at some point. And I don't have any particular insight into that. So this is data, but not, but that doesn't answer your question, which is a good one.
Okay, let's take the last question.
So this is semi below the bullshit line, but.
You mean so, right on the line?
I'll leave it to you. But so you know, what one of the things that has always struck me, you know, when you see a lot of these ruins that are out there, you know, from thousands of years ago, the thing that I was wondering was, you know, were they just really destroyed or they were just hanging out there and there was the influence and this was, so was it what kind of like your scent pile just was sitting there and, you know, it was not just sitting there, there was the seasons or whatever. I warned you. So, but what I'm understanding is not everything that I see destroyed was just sort of those ruins is basically destroyed by someone just kicking those stones, but there is, you know.
Right. No, so look, I obviously I know so little about architecture to be able to tell you that, but I do think that there is something about the berm behind the dam. I mean, dams give way. They are immensely dangerous and bad for anyone downstream. And often give way. And you know, one way you can think of that is, well, you know, these things have evolved, and then if this thing really is auxetic in the middle and there's pressure, that gives up a lot of space to the things around it. So this could be a trigger something, but you know, that's, I mean, if yours was here and that one was there.
Okay.